Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
And this is Andrew Peach with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. On the way, the impact of hurricane force winds and a national power blackout in Cuba.
It is, of course, affecting Cuban businesses. They have received a directive that schools and non-essential businesses will remain closed until Wednesday, when hopefully the complete collapse has been addressed.
The man who invented the BRICS group of countries on what they're achieving.
If you delve very close below the surface, there's a lot of things they disagree on. China and India, the two countries that really matter in the BRICS, rarely agree on anything.
And the man who invented the BRICS countries will be with us on the programme a little later. Also, the women football players who want nothing to do with Saudi Arabia.
Receiving money from a sponsor like Saudi Aramco, that's not the right thing to be part of.
You can contact the programme on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033, or drop us an email anytime at world.business@bbc.co.uk. We love hearing from you. We'll start with Cuba. Battered by heavy rain and winds of over 100 kilometres an hour after Hurricane Oscar made landfall, it was already struggling, though, with a nationwide power blackout, with schools and businesses closed until at least Wednesday. Here's Professor Pat Kumaraswamy, who's director of the Centre for Research on Cuba at the University of Nottingham. She sent us this voice note from her hotel.
There have been blackouts, no power. For some people, the power outages are as long as 24 hours. And sometimes that's combined with lack of water coming through the system as well. So you can imagine how difficult that is. Food prices are very, very volatile. So one of the main anxieties for months now has been the inability to know what food you're going to put on the table. You can't store food for longer than a couple of days in this kind of tropical climate. So it's that constant insecurity, the fact that people are living literally from day to day. It is, of course, affecting Cuban businesses, the state businesses. So they have received a directive that schools and any non-essential businesses will remain closed until Wednesday, when hopefully the complete collapse has been addressed. They are pretty much living from day to day as it is, but, you know, Cubans are very hospitable, very community-minded, so very few people at least are dealing with this on their own. They're doing what they can to share their resources and help one another.
Well, Dr. Tamaris Bartamonde is Research Fellow at the American University in Washington, D.C. She's live with us on World Business Report from Florida. First of all, let me check with you about your own family and friends who you've been speaking to in Cuba. What's the last couple of days been like for them?
It's been very difficult. Well, good morning to you and to everyone that is listening. Thank you for inviting me. It's been really difficult. These couple of days have been full of uncertainty, no news as how long it's going to last, the situation. Sometimes they had some electricity for a few minutes and the electricity went out again. They ran out of water early on Friday and Saturday. They had some of them didn't have gas for cooking. They didn't have a way to keep the food, refrigerated. And some people lost food and other perishables that are needed. Particularly friends with children had a more dire situation.
Now, the hurricane's one thing, but the power blackout is more avoidable, and it's been caused by really old technology and the energy infrastructure in Cuba.
Yes. The crisis has several causes, but in general, the most The biggest problems in Cuba right now is that traditional partners like Russia, for example, or Venezuela that could be supplying oil to Cuba have their own problems and they cannot put Cuba as a priority. The other thing is that the Cuban economic crisis that was triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic was worsened by the introduction of the monetary reform, and that led to a financial crisis that, of course, put the maintenance works in the power grid. It was not a priority. Obviously, we are seeing the results now. The Cuba's power grid and its power plants are mostly obsolete. Many of them from the Soviet Union era. That technology requires shorter cycles of maintenance that haven't been able to fulfill completely because of a lack of resources in many cases. Cuba have also made bigger efforts to slowly, could have done bigger efforts for slowly transition to more sustainable sources of energy, and they haven't, which means that the dependency of Cuba from fossil fuels is 95%. 95% of the generation depends on fossil fuels, and we don't have them. And Cuban oil, we know, is highly contaminated with sulfur, which also shortens the lifespan of these power or electricity or energy infrastructure.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed for that, Tamariz. So the energy infrastructure, coupled with Cuba's allies having their attention elsewhere. The president says it's about US sanctions. I'm not sure that is the entire story of what's happening right now. We'll keep you in touch here on World Business Report. Now, to the biggest mass lawsuit in British history, as 600,000 Brazilians, 2,000 Brazilian businesses and 46 Brazilian local authorities seek tens of billions of dollars in damages for the collapse of a mining dam in 2015. It was the worst environmental disaster in Brazil's history. 19 people were killed. Giovanna Rodrigues lost her 7-year-old son, Diago, when the dam collapsed.
When the disaster happened, he was in the next town, where he stayed with his grandmother so I could work. I heard the news, I ran there, and I saw everything destroyed. 7 days and 7 nights passed before I heard that they had found the body.
Live to our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, who's with me. Ione, just remind us what happened back in 2015.
Well, in 2015, the Fundão Dam, which was operated by Samarco, a mining company that was a joint enterprise between BHP and Vale, two of the world's biggest mining companies, collapsed. And this dam was used to store mining waste. So when it collapsed, it unleashed millions of cubic meters of toxic mud and waste, which swept pretty indiscriminately through communities in the area. It destroyed hundreds of homes, killed 19 people, and poisoned the river, which many people in the area relied on for drinking water, for growing crops, for animals, fishing, causing widespread damage across the region, some of which is still being repaired today.
Now, BHP and Vale, the two companies you mentioned, have already paid billions of dollars off the back of this incident. So why are we now seeing further legal action, not only in Brazil, but also in the Netherlands and today in London?
That's right. Well, basically what happened was after this disaster, BHP and Vale set up a foundation called the Renova Foundation, which is a sort of arm's length body they've set up in Brazil, which they fund. It's dispersed more than $7.7 billion so far in repairs and compensation actions to date. Some of what they're doing is rebuilding new homes, which they've offered to people who have been affected. And all the companies do say that they are committed to repairing the damage caused, but many of the people who were affected, those who lost loved ones, but also those who lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, lost land that they lived on, feel like they've not had enough of a say in what sort of compensation they get. They feel like they have been offered compensation, but some argue it's not enough. Others, for example, feel that there's not really been justice over time because both companies still don't accept liability for what happened. And obviously, it has been nearly a decade now since that disaster. So this lawsuit that's happening in the UK is hundreds of thousands of people who have decided with UK lawyers to take BHP to court in the UK because that's where the company was headquartered at the time. The first stage of this trial is really to determine whether or not BHP themselves were liable for the disaster, whether that parent company was liable, and if so, what damages might be owed in addition to those that have already been paid out. Now, separately, people who didn't join that UK lawsuits have joined one against Vale in the Netherlands. Both companies have agreed that if either of them are found liable in these fresh lawsuits, then they would split the damages that they may be owed 50-50. But they, as I say, continue to say that they are not liable for what happened. They are committed to trying to kind of repair the damage that's been caused and that they've already started doing that.
Ione, thank you very much. Ione Wells is our South America correspondent. It's the biggest mass lawsuit in history, and we're going to move on from that to a aircraft manufacturer which says it wants to do a deal with its own employees after a very long strike that's been affecting Boeing. The offer that they've made to workers is of 35% over 4 years. Workers wanted 40. Rachel Winter is partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. What do you make of it, Rachel? Is this the end of this rather unhappy phase for Boeing?
Well, yeah, it's been such a difficult few years for Boeing, and it's largely got problems due to its own making. It's had those fatal crashes due to safety problems with its planes. It's had COVID. And now, as you say, it's got 33,000 of its workers on strike, and they've been on strike since the middle of September. Now, over the weekend, Boeing has made an improved offer to those employees. And at the moment, the share price is up a little bit over 4%. So that suggests that people think that the workers will accept this new deal. But despite today's rise in the share price, the shares have still lost a huge amount over the last 5 years. So over the last 5 years, the stock is down over 50%, whereas the S&P 500, by comparison, has nearly doubled in value. So it really has been a difficult few years for Boeing investors and employees as well.
Yeah, because there's still 17,000 jobs going, and the chief executive, Kelly Ortberg, is still expecting many more new losses as this year continues.
Yes, so this new offer definitely does not give the workers everything they want. They don't want anyone to be made redundant. And also the workers had been requesting a continuation of the existing defined benefit pension scheme. And this latest offer from the company does not meet that need. So we'll have to wait and see if the workers do accept this latest deal.
Right.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Stay with me. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. And you're going to hear a fair bit about BRICS this week as the 16th annual summit of this group of countries named after Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa is being hosted by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Its members, including some new ones who are going for the first time, account for a third of the world's GDP and 40% of its population. Here's Leanna Byrne.
BRIC was so-called due to the emerging nations of Brazil, Russia, India and China becoming the first four establishing nations back in 2009. A year later, South Africa joined, so BRIC became BRICS. It was set up to foster economic cooperation, development financing and political coordination among its members. And for 15 years, that's how it stayed. Then last year, it announced it was expanding. Here's India Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Today we have agreed to welcome Argentina, Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia and UAE into BRICS. India will also contribute to creating a consensus for other countries that have expressed the desire to join BRICS as partner countries.
Argentina withdrew shortly after, but there's plenty of other countries still bidding to join. The mission of BRICS is impressive on paper, but criticism levelled at the group has been that it talks a good game but has fallen short on delivering anything of substance, a point Chinese President Xi Jinping thinks is changing.
It will bring new vigour. Let us work together to write a new chapter of emerging market countries and developing countries working together in unity for development.
So what next? One topic is the development of a new currency for BRICS members, as it looks to de-dollarize the global economy. In other words, reducing its reliance on the US dollar for international trade and as a reserve currency. And according to Russia's Vladimir Putin, alternatives are being explored.
I would like to especially emphasize the issues for mutual currency settlement, the united currency issue. This is a challenging task. Nevertheless, we will move towards resolution.
So is it feasible that the US dollar could lose its place as the preeminent global currency? Margaret Myers is director of the Asia and Latin America program at the Inter-American Dialogue and specializes in all things BRICS.
No, I don't think there's broad backing for this idea, including among, you know, the foundational members of the BRICS. There is a broad interest in reducing dependence on the US dollar through the use of other currencies. If you don't have broad support among the, you know, the five foundational members for this really, you know, major endeavor, then I think it's very unlikely to happen.
As BRICS evolves, the question remains, will it succeed in creating a more balanced global order, or will internal differences hinder its progress?
Well, Jim O'Neill is a British economist, best known for coining the acronym BRICS. He's told World Business Report the organisation no longer knows what it's for. I asked him what, if anything, it had delivered on so far.
I think pointing out the fact that the IMF, the World Bank and all the rest of the post-war World War II global governance isn't really suitable for this world, that is a success. And to some degree, the creation of the New Development Bank, which was known as the BRICS Bank originally, is kind of successful, but it's not clear to me what it is they're even trying to really achieve beyond that symbolism.
With China so huge, has it become China with basically a fan club gathered around it?
I think that's not an unreasonable point or question to raise and discuss. China's as big as all the others times two. And without China, one would wonder whether they could make the noise that they make. And I do think China loves this notion of being the real powerhouse representing the interests of, let's call it, the global south. And they definitely were key to the expansion to what might now be called BRICS Plus. But again, it doesn't strike me that this is a central part of China's real interests, but it's really powerful symbolism for them. And therefore it kind of suits them.
Let's just focus on Russia for a second or two. Russia's engagement with the entire world is entirely changed after the invasion of Ukraine. How has that played out in this club?
If you and your listeners take their minds back to 2001, in those distant days, Russia was part of then the G8 because it had been deliberately changed from 7 to 8 in order to incorporate Russia when the West was in love with them post the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, of course, since the first invasion in, 2014 of parts of Ukraine or Crimea, things have got worse and worse and worse. And obviously, particularly with the Russians being hosts this week, you would imagine Putin is going to try and make a big song and dance out of the supposed importance of this club.
And I suppose it is true that the other members of BRICS have largely remained neutral about Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
I think if you go back to what is the purpose of this thing, that the one thing that all the big countries in it, including India and to some degree Brazil, they like the fact that it's pointing out how underrepresented each of them are still in the likes of the IMF, the World Bank and the UN and so on. And so they don't want to upset the apple cart by being noisy about things they might disagree with other BRICS members. But if you delve very close below the surface, there's a lot of things they disagree on. China and India, the two countries that really matter in the BRICS, rarely agree on anything. And I'm pretty sure for the likes of India, who've arguably played it very skillfully, they want to have a foot in both camps. And that's certainly true to some degree with Brazil. And it's definitely true with many of the other emerging countries that are being invited to this meeting, although they're not becoming members. But they do like the symbolism of it because they feel the global governance conditions that exist today are still far too dominated by the Old West, including what are many relatively declining economies.
One of the long-standing ideas that's talked about is de-dollarizing the currency of the world, so not everything happens in US dollars. That's in itself such a symbol of US and Western dominance. Does it ever get anywhere, this idea?
People have been talking about replacing the dollar for the 40 years that I've been in global economics and especially global finance. And emerging nations, particularly big ones, China especially, have on and off talked about it endlessly ever since the BRICS idea came around. And the simple reality is the dollar is far more represented in global finance and global trade transactions than is warranted by the US's size in the world economy, which is obviously still extremely large, but not as large as the role of the dollar. But the reason why that is the case is all the other potential serious contenders to having their currency used more freely never want to take the responsibilities that go with being a global reserve currency. Whatever they say at these kind of get-togethers is sort of meaningless. Despite that, I suspect there will be a lot of noise made about it again, especially because, of course, the host country, Russia, is very eager to try and find some way to develop some vague payments mechanism that can avoid the wrath of Western sanctions.
And just finally, what, if anything, can emerge from the discussions that are coming up?
I would love to see some kind of really transparent, clear agenda about what it is the BRICS members, now including the other four, could realistically try to achieve and identify the areas where they really, really want to do more together. And there are some, despite the tone of everything I've said. If they had truly greater trade between themselves and freer trade of freer tariffs, and of course, given global climate change issues and pollution, many of these countries are ones that really need to do something for their own interests, and they could easily do a lot more together to help, not just themselves, but also the world. And then on things like major infectious diseases, where many of these countries have a huge challenge, especially, for example, with drug-resistant TB. But they never seem to really focus on these things. They rather just make all these noises. And, of course, they could do something about the global financial system, but that requires them to do something about reforming their own financial markets rather than just making these noises, which, of course, is very easy to get a lot of media coverage, but it doesn't really mean anything.
The economist Jim O'Neill. We talked about China and its contribution to BRICS. Let's stay with China. The central bank has cut interest rates to try and stimulate the economy. Rachel Winter from Killick & Co is still with me. What do you make of that, Rachel? Because the Beijing stock market liked it.
It did. So China has cut two of its key interest rates, and these particular interest rates are used as reference rates for a lot of mortgages, business loans and consumer loans. So these cuts should really help to stimulate some economic activity. But it is a concern that these cuts were necessary in the first place. And if we look at China's growth rate, it's currently 4.6%. That's below China's target growth rate of 5%. So that's the reason these cuts are needed. But if we look at China's growth rate over the longer term, I mean, for the latter part of the 90s and all the way up until the financial crisis, the Chinese economy was growing at around 10% per year. So it really has come down a long way. And with that in mind, it's not surprising that the central bank is really trying to prop up that growth rate.
We've got a change at the top of the Disney Corporation today. Tell me more.
Yeah, so they've announced a new chairman who will be stepping in at the start of 2025. But what was particularly interesting about the announcement was they've said they are looking to appoint a successor to the chief executive, Bob Iger, in 2026. Now, Disney has really struggled to move away from Mr. Iger, who previously stepped away and then came back. So I will be really interested to hear a bit more about that succession plan.
You know how every member of staff at Disney is called a cast member? I wonder if the chairman and CEO are also cast members in the same sort of way.
I hope so.
That'd be good. I hope so. Hope they've got that on their office door. Thank you for being with us, Rachel. Really appreciate it. Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. live on World Business Report. Now, FIFA say they want football to be inclusive. If so, they should make sure their sponsorships lead by example. That from a group of more than 100 professional women footballers who want FIFA to end its sponsorship deal with the state-owned Saudi Arabian oil giant Aramco because of its treatment of women and criminalisation of gay relationships. Here's Sophie Junger-Pedersen, who's a Danish professional footballer, who signed the letter.
We need to ask ourselves what we want to be part of. Receiving money from a sponsor like Saudi Aramco, whose owner, who's the Saudi state, that's not the right thing to be part of. And we hear many human rights organizations who tells that this is a strategy from the Saudi state to use sport as a way to beautifying the picture of the situation in Saudi Arabia.
We asked Aramco to come on World Business Report. We haven't heard back from them yet. FIFA sent us a statement saying it values its partnership with Aramco and its many other commercial and rights partners. Lisa Parfitt is co-founder of the sports marketing agency The Space Between. Lisa, thank you for being with us. These sort of protests, this letter, this sort of thing is becoming more common. Would it make a blind bit of difference, though?
Unlikely, I think, in this particular scenario. They are becoming increasingly common. We saw over the summer in Britain with a number of different British banks who were pushed out of sponsoring literary festivals and music festivals linked to their relationships with arms deals and fossil fuels and Israel. You're starting to see players starting to make a stand now as well. In the NBA sponsor is Gatorade. You've seen players starting to remove Gatorade from the press conference tables, etc. You're starting to see players starting to really use their platform now to protest against sponsors that don't align with their values. However, in the past, Infantino has made it quite clear he's very keen on Saudi backing the women's game. And it was back in the FIFA Women's World Cup last year in 2023 when there were rumours of Visit Saudi sponsoring the tournament that was being hosted in Australia and New Zealand, which actually didn't end up happening. It wasn't a deal that had been done. And again, players stepped in, similar players that have written the letter today saying this doesn't align with the values of the game. And they stepped away. But it was at that point that Infantino doubled down and says that he very much expects to see Saudi backing the women's game in the future.
And the other side of the coin is that the women's game really needs money and that this is a source of plenty of it.
You're absolutely right. There's a real tension here between the women's game that is looking and everybody who's working in and around the women's game looking to increase the commercial revenues, which is going to ultimately drive grassroots participation, strength, player pathways, equal pay, equal prize fund. And yet actually what the players are saying is they're not willing to sacrifice the values of the game just to have sponsors come in and increase the revenue. Equality, diversity and inclusion is a deep commitment within the women's game. And then they're not willing, they'd rather use their platform to push against sponsors like that and sponsors that they don't feel align rather than just simply take the money.
All right, Lisa, thank you. That's Lisa Parfitt. Of course, FIFA are unlikely to drop the partnership, but Aramco may decide it's too much bad PR and they might pull out. We'll see. Thank you for being with us. From me, Andrew Peach and the team, that was World Business Report.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.